Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Ben hadn't had a decent night's sleep in a month. So, during one of his restless nights, he booked a package trip abroad on Expedia. When he arrived at his beachside hotel, he discovered a miraculous bed slung between two trees and fell into the best sleep of his life. You were made to be rechargeable. We were made to package flights and hotels and hammocks for less. Expedia. Made to travel.
Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. Hollywood Exiles, from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 27th of January, these are our main stories. Israel has dismissed a ruling by the UN's highest court, ordering it to take all necessary steps to prevent acts of genocide in Gaza. The United States has paused funding to the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees after some of its employees were accused of taking part in the Hamas attack against Israel. A jury in New York has ordered Donald Trump to pay $83.3 million in damages to the writer E. Jean Carroll. Also in this podcast,
these little ant defenders of these acacia trees, which are very widespread in Africa, are very effective defenders of the trees, particularly against elephants. And the ants swarm up the elephant's trunk and bite it and keep elephants from disturbing these trees very much in the landscape.
But how can this lead to an ecological chain reaction also affecting lions and zebras? Israel has dismissed a ruling by the UN's highest court, ordering it to take all necessary steps to prevent acts of genocide in Gaza, although the judges stopped short of demanding an immediate ceasefire. South Africa brought the case at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, accusing Israel of committing genocide against Palestinians and saying it should be halted. Well, the court said Israel had to immediately allow more urgently needed aid to enter the territory and to prevent and punish the direct incitement of genocide in the conflict. Israel's far-right security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, described the ICJ as an anti-Semitic court seeking the persecution of the Jewish people. The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, insisted Israel would continue to defend itself while respecting international law.
Israel's commitment to international law is unwavering. Equally unwavering is our sacred commitment to continue to defend our country and defend our people. Like every country, Israel has an inherent right to defend itself. The vile attempt to deny Israel this fundamental right is blatant discrimination against the Jewish state, and it was justly rejected. The charge of genocide leveled against Israel is not only false, it's outrageous, and decent people everywhere should reject it.
These people in Gaza told the BBC Arabic service that they were disappointed by the court's ruling.
We had high hopes of the International Court of Justice. The decision, as expected, was to continue this war on us. We don't want aid, we just want a ceasefire, and that's what we're waiting for.
We felt betrayed because there is no ceasefire or even a truce, which could make the situation more bearable for us. People are living in tents and are displaced, including children. We are all displaced here. The situation is very dire. We expected to reach a truce leading to a ceasefire.
Paul Henley spoke to our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, who's been studying the case brought by South Africa.
Well, I think it's significant. It's significant because Israel wanted the court to throw the whole thing out. And the court has not just not thrown it out. They've said that there is a plausible case to answer that Israel may have committed genocide. They haven't prejudged that. They say it's without prejudice, but they have also ordered these interim measures, which essentially say to the Israelis, you have to fight your war in Gaza in a very different way. I think it's significant.
Is Israel in any way compelled to A, listen, and B, act?
Yep, they are supposed to listen to what the International Court says. It's part of the United Nations system and it's their highest court. However, there is no enforcement mechanism. I suppose there could be a Security Council resolution, perhaps, but even then, you don't necessarily have to follow those things if they're not enforced under certain parts of the UN Charter. So I think really what it is, it's more moral pressure, actually. And also the court has said to the Israelis that they need to report back in a month to show just what progress they've made in doing the things the court wants. And bearing in mind that there's now going to be a lengthy legal process involving Israel and the court and the South Africans, it may be that the Israelis do not want to alienate those justices.
If Israeli government ministers don't feel that moral pressure, do you think some Israeli citizens might and put pressure on their government?
The war itself has overwhelming support inside Israel. I think there are those in the country who've hardened their heart to Palestinian casualties, who've said, they've said it's not our fault. You know, we were attacked and we are defending ourselves. And there are others who say, look, it's really unfortunate, but what can we do? There are very few people inside Israel, among Jewish Israelis, who say that Israel is killing too many Palestinians, which is what the Americans and many other allies of Israel have said.
In the International Court of Public Opinion, what effect do you think today's ruling might have?
I think it will be significant because those who oppose what Israel's doing have some more ammunition, which they will try and use against the Israelis. Now, Israel will, of course, be defended by its friends. It already has been by the Americans and by others, by the Germans. And I think that, you know, Israel will stoutly push back against these accusations as they have already. But a process has begun and it's going to be long and drawn out. But there are some immediate changes that the court has asked for, and that's something that is measurable. So if that doesn't get delivered, well, there may be, who knows, maybe the court will try and take other measures.
Might Hamas be thinking this is a good day?
Hamas have put out a statement welcoming it, as have other Palestinian groups, as has the Palestinian Authority. So, yeah, they're happy about it, and the South Africans are happy about it. They were dancing and celebrating. The Israelis, meanwhile, having said initially that they wanted the court to throw the whole thing out, the Israelis are particularly fastening on to the point that there was no demand for a ceasefire, that their right to defend themselves has been upheld by the court, has not been challenged. Now, I'm not surprised the court didn't go along with South Africa's request for an immediate ceasefire because Hamas attacked Israel and under the UN Charter, states have the right of self-defense. And it's one of the, you know, it's a justification for war. But to stress again, the International Court has said that Israel has to conduct its war in a very different way.
Jeremy Bowen. The United States is pausing funding for the UN Agency for Palestinians, UNRWA, over allegations that some of its staff were involved in the October the 7th attack by Hamas on Israel. The head of UNRWA, Philippe Lazzarini, said the agency had taken the necessary steps in order to protect its ability to deliver humanitarian aid. From Washington, Tom Bateman has the details.
UNRWA says it sacked several staff after Israel passed it information alleging they were involved in the October the 7th attacks. The agency says it started an investigation and anyone involved in terrorism will be held accountable. US State Department officials say they are extremely troubled by the claims and are withholding further funding to UNRWA until they're satisfied it's been looked into. The UN agency has a staff of 30,000 and provides health, education, food and welfare for millions of Palestinian refugees, including 1.7 million people in Gaza.
Tom Bateman. As we record this podcast, there are reports that an oil tanker is on fire in the Gulf of Aden after Yemen's Houthi movements said it had launched missiles at the vessel. The operator of the Marlin Luanda said one of its cargo tanks was ablaze. US officials say a nearby naval ship is responding and there appear to be no injuries. Well, the Houthis in Yemen have been targeting ships in the Red Sea in solidarity, they say, with Palestinians in Gaza. In response, the United States and Britain have launched a series of strikes against Houthi targets. On Thursday, the head of the Houthi movement in Yemen, Abdel Malik al-Houthi, said military action by the US and its allies against Yemen would be counterproductive. The BBC Persian Service correspondent Nafisa Konavard has in recent days been granted special access to an allied warship patrolling the Red Sea.
Back in the relative calm of the Mediterranean, we are on board a military helicopter alongside a team of US Marines. They were the first responders to the Houthi attacks on commercial shipping. Emerging over the horizon, we spot our destination, the amphibious assault ship, the USS Bataan. The Bataan is the lead ship of its U.S. Navy group, home to around 2,000 Marines, landing craft and jump jets. It's designed for rapid reaction. Their commander, Colonel Dennis Sampson, says their mission is now about deterrence.
I think there's always a risk of miscalculation, but our presence matters, and we serve as a deterrent, prepared to respond in support of our national security interests or the interests of our allies and partners.
But that deterrent proved ineffective against the Houthis. Declaring their support for the people of Gaza, they began a series of attacks on Red Sea shipping lanes, targeting vessels they claim are linked to Israel and the West. The U.S. has since led strikes on their military bases in Yemen, but the group say they will continue their campaign for as long as Gazan civilians are being killed. We were flown from the Bataan to the USS Arleigh, a guided missile destroyer ship, and then taken down into its command center for a simulation.
Stand by for missile intercept 1234.
To the right over here, it's called Air Alley. So those are my air defense watchstanders, ensuring that if there's a threat that's coming through the air, that they're able to see it, watch it, and monitor everything that's flying.
Leading the demonstration is Lieutenant Commander Bowman.
I would identify as they are operating what I call at a really high tempo right now. They're operating in an environment where they're either protecting other ships, keeping the sea lanes of traffic open for trade, or protecting themselves at this point.
The U.S. says it doesn't want further escalation, but as long as war in Gaza continues, this group don't know when they will be heading home.
Nafisa Kernavard from BBC Persian. Next to the United States, and a jury in New York has ordered the former U.S. President Donald Trump to pay $83.3 million in damages to the writer E. Jean Carroll. Mr. Trump had already been found to have defamed Ms. Carroll with comments he made about her in 2019 whilst he was president. The jury had been deciding on a figure for damages and has awarded a sum far higher than her lawyers had requested. I spoke to our correspondent Neda Torfik, who was outside the court in New York, and asked her first to remind us of the case.
This was a second defamation trial, and it followed a first one in May where Donald Trump was found by a separate jury to be liable for sexually abusing E. Jean Carroll at a Bergdorf Goodman department store in the 90s and then defaming her by saying she was a liar, that the case was a hoax, and that she was just trying to sell a new memoir. Now, this case focused on statements he made while he was president in 2019. And what we saw here was the jury had one question before them. The facts of this case were already established in the first trial, the judge said, so they just had to decide how much to award E. Jean Carroll, if anything, in damages. And what we saw was that they were very much convinced by E. Jean Carroll's lawyers. They decided to award E. Jean Carroll a total of $83.3 million. And let me just break that down. They decided $7.3 million would be awarded to her for emotional harm, $11 million for reputational harm, because remember, she was an advice columnist. She said she began getting attacks from Donald Trump supporters and lost her job. Then the big piece of this was $65 million was awarded for what is called punitive damages. And that is the amount that the jury decided it would take for Donald Trump to stop defaming E. Jean Carroll. We heard earlier in the court, Roberta Kaplan, E. Jean Carroll's lawyers, saying that he was a billionaire, that the only way he would stop defaming her, as he has continued to do at his campaign events, on social media, even throughout this trial, was to make him pay. And so the jury decided deciding $65 million was a high enough number, a substantial enough number, to try to convince him to do just that.
Ned, Donald Trump has responded on the Trump Truth Social site saying this is absolutely ridiculous. I fully disagree with the verdicts. We're going to be appealing. It's all part of a Biden-directed witch hunt. Things that he said many times before. What impact on him will there be beyond the financial loss for this, do you think?
Yeah, well, look, I think certainly the financial hit will make him perhaps take a look and reassess his strategy. But I think his legal considerations have really taken a back seat to how this has been really a winning formula for his campaign, showing up in court, calling it a witch hunt. And I don't think he will stop that strategy.
Neda Torfik in New York. There's an ecological chain reaction taking place in Kenya. It starts with some invasive ants living in acacia trees and ends with much of the food chain being affected, including elephants, lions and zebras as well. Todd Palmer, who's a researcher from the University of Florida, told us what's been going on.
These little ant defenders of these acacia trees, which are very widespread in Africa, are very effective defenders of the trees, particularly against elephants, in part because an elephant has a 9-foot nose that essentially extends into the canopy of the tree. And the ants swarm up the elephant's trunk and bite it and keep the elephants from disturbing these trees very much in the landscape. So we started with that observation and learned that when these ants are present, they are very effective defenders of the tree. But recently, within the last 15 to 20 years, an invasive ant has shown up in these landscapes, a tiny, innocuous-seeming ant. We didn't even notice it for the first few years that it was present. And this invasive ant is actually killing off all of the native acacia ants, which is effectively the tree's body armor. As a result of that, the elephants are coming in and clearing out the landscape. The thing about an elephant is that they can actually consume an entire tree rather than just taking little nibbles of it. So they're actually clearing out trees entirely, destroying them and killing them off. So as these more wooded grasslands become more open, essentially they become tougher places for lions to hunt. Lions are sort of stalking and ambush predators, so they rely on tree cover to be able to sneak up close enough to their prey that they can kind of run out and pounce on them. And so as the landscapes become more open, they're having a harder time, we found, killing zebra. The good news is that the lions are doing something. So as they've been less successful at preying on zebra, they've turned their intentions towards buffalo. So we haven't seen any changes in the lions' populations.
Todd Palmer from the University of Florida. Still to come. But can a children's TV program make a successful switch to the big screen with the help of Jennifer Lopez?
This is the story of a powerful Nigerian televangelist.
He was a huge celebrity and he had a way of presenting himself as man of God.
Who attracted followers to his church from around the globe.
It was like going to heaven and being asked to stay.
But once there, some say that TB Joshua used his power to control, manipulate and abuse. This is World of Secrets from the BBC World Service. Season 2, The Disciple.
We all thought we were in heaven, but we were in hell, and in hell, terrible things happen.
Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Next, to Japan. He was on the run for half a century, and now one of the most wanted men in the country has apparently turned up in a hospital. Satoshi Kirishima was a member of a radical group that carried out bombings in Tokyo in the 1970s. The gang, calling itself the East Asian Anti-Japan Armed Front, targeted large corporations in the capital and killed a number of people. The BBC's Will Leonardo knows the case well.
This man is called Satoshi Kirishima. He's now 70 years old. And to be honest, there'd been a sense voiced by a lot of people on social media today that they thought that he might have died, as nothing had been heard from him in, you know, years and years. And while many people might have forgotten his name, his face is fairly well recognised, as a photo of him as a young man is plastered all over these Japanese Kobam police boxes, the tiny little police stations all around Japan. There are thousands of them where, you know, you might have one or two officers. So people would have seen his face probably every day just walking along the street. And what the photo shows, it's not a mugshot because they never caught him, but it shows him as a young man with glasses, kind of long hair, looking, you know, kind of quite like a kind of young student in the 70s would. Kirishima has been wanted by police for decades, for 50 years, for alleged involvement in these bombings on companies in Tokyo, and also for violations of explosive regulations as part of this far-left group called the East Asia Anti-Japan Armed Front. He's particularly accused of involvement in the bombing that tore off the facade of a building in Tokyo's upscale Ginza district in 1975. The building had housed what was described as a Korean industrial research unit.
And for people in Japan, if this man does prove to be who he says he is, it would sort of mark perhaps an end of a pretty painful period of Japanese history.
I mean, in a sense, this group, the East Asia Anti-Japan Armed Front, kind of classified as a far-left sort of terrorist group, they caused, you know, some of the worst bombings that Japan's seen since the end of the Second World War, and people still remember them. The most kind of notorious one was an attack on the Mitsubishi headquarters, in which 8 people died in 1974. It's worth kind of noting, you know, the history of this group. It comes out of the student protests and the agitation of the late 60s and the 70s, also seen in other parts of the world. They were avowedly anti-imperialist. Their kind of main targets were large corporations in Tokyo who were involved in Japanese imperialism before the Second World War, and when Japan's economy was taking off again in the 70s, had started putting their feelers out to kind of going back to countries, obviously in peacetime, in East Asia, which this group had taken kind of umbrage against. I mean, in terms of him being caught, you know, it's hard to say with certainty if we know that this man who's now been in hospital with terminal cancer is actually Satoshi Kirishima. But, you know, if you look at the motive, why would you come forward and say, I'm this man, if you know that in Japan you're probably going to face a death penalty for the charges that have been brought against you? And, you know, in local media are already saying that it appears, you know, police are questioning him, they're doing DNA tests, he's under detention, and, you know, there's a sense that this man apparently, according to some reports, has already said that he wanted to die using his real name.
Will Leonardo. The American Museum of Natural History in New York is to close 2 galleries which display Native American artifacts. It joins institutions across the United States which are responding to new federal regulations that require them to gain tribal consent before Native American and Hawaiian artifacts can be displayed. Richard Howells reports.
The museum has extensive collections of artifacts and cultural items from the many and varied native peoples who live in North America and Hawaii. The Biden administration has been keen to speed up the return of significant items to their original Native American owners. Curators have consulted tribal groups about the sensitivity of displaying objects and finding ways of returning items which often hold huge significance to their original cultures.
Richard Howells. Staying in the US, to a case now that's become TikTok's latest obsession. 5 men in Kansas City gathered to watch a football match on January the 7th, and only 2 of them survived. 3 were found frozen to death in their friend's back garden days later. Well, the mysterious case has baffled authorities and stirred up hundreds of online sleuths with thousands of videos being uploaded.
I'm sure everyone's heard that something shady is going on in Kansas City.
How is it possible that the man living in this house had no idea 3 of his friends were laying dead in his backyard for more than 2 days?
Why would you not call 911?
I've been in touch with victim families on this app.
This man has 2 dogs. You're telling me that he didn't let his dogs out in the backyard at any point?
Anyways, what do you think happened? Please drop in the comments because this case is incredibly bizarre.
Our reporter Stephanie Prentice has been following the story.
In short, this was a normal social gathering at a home that ended in 3 deaths, with those bodies lying in the backyard of that property for 2 days while the man renting the home was still inside. The bodies were actually only found after the fiancé of one of the deceased, she broke into the property's basement to try and find him because his car was parked outside, and then she found a body on the back porch. Now, the man who was renting the house, he's called Jordan Willis, he'd been hosting friends for a football game. He claims he said goodbye to 4 of them at the end of the night and went to sleep, but 3 of those men died in his back garden, seemingly frozen to death as Kansas was having sub-zero temperatures at the time. Now, the aspects, as you mentioned, that people online are grappling with most is how Jordan Willis failed to realise this had happened or to see those bodies in the days that followed or to question those cars that were parked on his driveway. He says he didn't get any calls and messages as their friends and family tried to find them, but people have claimed they were trying to contact him, they were banging on his door and he was just ignoring them. Police also seem baffled over what happened because they say there were no signs of violence and they're not currently treating this as a homicide case, although toxicology results are pending. This actually seems to be driving people online to push for answers, and also the families of the men who died, they're fueling this as well. They say Jordan Willis's story isn't adding up, although Jordan Willis does deny any wrongdoing.
And Steph, a lot of crimes online, they seem to reach some kind of tipping point, don't they? And then the interest in them explodes.
They do. So this rise in amateur detectives, or citizen sleuths as some call them, it's often put down to this boom in popularity of true crime content. And there are many cases where people have used the internet to get cold cases reopened and then solved, or even track down fugitives. To name a couple, the podcast called Your Own Backyard, that helped authorities arrest someone in a 25-year-old missing persons case in California, and a podcast called The Teacher's Pet in Australia that led to a man being charged for his wife's murder. Now, over on TikTok particularly, mysterious deaths seem to captivate content makers and viewers there. You might remember the blogger Gabby Petito. She was found dead after travelling across country with her boyfriend. More than 600 million people viewed content with her name as a hashtag. That also happened in the Idaho 4 case, the four teenager students that were found murdered. Those videos racked up more than 2 billion views. Some have called this new trend true crime goes live. But of course, it's important to remember the heart of this is loss of life, grieving families, as well as people being wrongly accused. And former journalists that have turned TikTok detectives themselves, they make videos advising others to take caution and also to ensure accuracy when making these kind of videos.
Stephanie Prentice. In Britain, King Charles is said to be doing well after being treated in London on Friday for an enlarged prostate. The condition is common, affecting one in three men aged over 50. The King is in the same private hospital where the Princess of Wales had surgery last week. Our correspondent Charlotte Gallagher sent this report from outside the London clinic.
We've heard that he's had the procedure, as you said, and he's now recuperating. We saw Queen Camilla leaving the hospital a short while earlier. She arrived with the King this morning and obviously wanted to be at the hospital while the procedure was taking place, and she left a short while ago. So it does appear that the King will be spending tonight in the hospital. Perhaps he'll be in the hospital over the weekend. We just don't know, because recuperation for every patient is so different. Many people have wondered, why has the King been so open about his diagnosis? That's so unusual for the royal family. And he said it was to raise awareness, essentially, for men to check their prostates, get them checked. And before he was admitted for the procedure, Buckingham Palace issued a statement saying the King was delighted that his diagnosis had helped raise public health awareness about getting prostates checked. There's another member of the royal family, another senior member of the royal family in this hospital, the Princess of Wales. She's here as well. She's recuperating from surgery. And we do know that the King, in fact, visited the princess before he had his procedure earlier today. And her recuperation is going to be a lot longer. We don't expect to see her back in public doing public duties until after Easter.
Charlotte Gallagher. Next to sport, and the manager of Liverpool Football Club, Jurgen Klopp, has announced that he will stand down at the end of the season. The 56-year-old, whose team is top of the Premier League, said he was running out of energy. Klopp took charge of Liverpool in 2015 and has won 6 trophies, including the Premier League title and the Champions League. Our sports correspondent Andy Swiss has this report.
And there goes the final whistle. They've won the Champions League. They're European champions.
He brought the trophies and the feel-good factor back to Liverpool, but on the club's TV channel, Jurgen Klopp made a shock announcement.
I will leave the club at the end of the season. I'm running out of energy. I'm absolutely fine now, but I know that I cannot do the job again. And again, and again, and again.
With his customary charisma, Klopp said he was like a sports car, still at top speed, but running out of petrol. And in a media conference later, he insisted it was the right decision.
It means so much, and it's so important for so many people. I cannot do it on three wheels. It was not allowed. And I don't never wanted to be a passenger in all that. My managing skills, it's based on energy, on emotion, on relationships and all these kind of things. And that takes all of you. That's just how it is. It needs all of you. And if I cannot be that anymore, stop it and tell the people.
After arriving at Anfield in 2015, Klopp's blend of chest-thumping passion with a full-throttle style, which he called heavy metal football, soon won over the fans. It won titles too, including the Champions League in 2019 and a long-awaited Premier League triumph the following year. Liverpool are currently flying high at the top of the table. So for the fans, today's news was even harder to take.
I'm in shock. It's terrible. I mean, you can understand maybe he's just exhausted and hopefully we can win everything this year in his final year, but I just don't know who would come next.
Just gobsmacked, really. Just thinking who's going to come in next now. That's the main concern, isn't it?
Him leaving is a big shock and it'll be a shock to everyone, but it's the replacements that people are going to be worried about.
Klopp says he won't manage again in England and may yet retire altogether. But whatever the future holds, his status as a Liverpool legend is guaranteed.
Andy Swiss reporting on the manager of Liverpool Football Club, Jurgen Klopp, who's announced that he's going to stand down at the end of the season. He is Bob the Builder, or Bob der Baumeister, or Bob el Constructor. The British cartoon character comes in many guises in many countries. Well, the rights were bought by the toy manufacturer Mattel of Barbie fame more than a decade ago. And now an unlikely revamp is in the offing, as our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson reports.
One is known as Jenny from the block. The other works with Breeze Blocks. Now, the unlikely duo of the singer and film star Jennifer Lopez and Bob the Builder are teaming up to make a film.
Right, well, there's been some serious storm damage and we're needed right away.
Bob the Builder was first broadcast back in 1999. By the following year, Bob was so popular, he had the Christmas number one single. In 2011, Mattel bought the rights to Bob the Builder. And following the success of the Barbie film, they're looking at which other of their characters could work on the big screen. Enter J-Lo, whose production company is going to give an animated film a Latino twist, with Roberto the Builder, voiced by Anthony Ramos, heading to Puerto Rico to work on a major construction. This is only one of a number of new films planned by Mattel.
New Hot Wheels, only from Mattel.
The man who rebooted Star Wars, J.J. Abrams, is turning his attention to toy cars with the Hot Wheels movie. The creator of Girls, Lena Dunham, is hoping for another doll-based hit with a Polly Pocket film. And there is even talk of Uno the card game somehow being turned into a heist movie.
All right, team, it's home time.
As for Bob the Builder and Jennifer Lopez, this week Barbie secured a Best Picture nomination at the Oscars. Could they do the same?
Yes, we can!
Colin Patterson reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Matt Dean. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.